Warning! Today's Christmas story contains some profanity, some violence, and some rock and roll. The North Pole Advisory Council warns that it may be disturbing and/or disillusioning to young children.
Escape Pod 85, December 21st, 2006. Today's story, Merry Christmas from the Heartbreakers, by Merle Atherty.
Hello, and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely, and this week we're brought to you by, well, no one. But if you're still looking for a charity to donate to, I'd invite you to consider Reading is Fundamental and or Child's Play. Child's Play is Penny Arcade's drive to bring toys and games to sick kids in hospitals, and Reading is Fundamental gives children's books to kids who don't have any. There are a lot of deserving groups out there, and I'm not suggesting these are better than any others, but they are the ones I'm giving to this year. So this is, obviously, a Christmas episode. I originally wasn't going to make a big deal out of it. In recent years, I've been getting more and more jaded about Christmas. I'm not a religious person, but I could still respect the sacred aspects of it if I thought society was paying any attention to them. The problem is that virtually nothing about Christmas, as American culture observes it today, is really about Christ. It's mostly a completely arbitrary set of traditions and dress codes and compulsory shopping that doesn't really signify anything except itself, and anyway, you've heard all this before. So that's the mood I went into this season with. It's not the attitude I have now. What changed my mind is, well, this is all cliched, but it was Alex. I realized that this holiday isn't really for me, not the tired 30-something me who thinks that one day is the same length as any other. It's for the kid me who couldn't wait to race downstairs every year, who had fun with the songs and the wrapping paper and the trees, and didn't question sincerity or commercialism. And now it's for my son, who's going on too and has the same things to look forward to. It would be a shame, bordering on malice, to allow my cynicism to ruin my kids' Christmases. But more than that, having to think about him makes me start to understand why people bother. I said once before that at a certain age, everything in the world is science fiction. It's all wonders beyond understanding. And Christmas, from a child's eye view, is the time when the entire world lights up, when all the adults sing and wear bright colors and decorate everything and eat sweets and play, when everybody celebrates and acts as if life is good. And if that's what it looked like to me once, and if that's what it looks like to my child, well, maybe there's something to it. If responsible parenthood demands that I celebrate and have fun and realize joy in the world, I'm going to have to make that sacrifice. With that said, today's story is not for your children. It's for you. We present Merry Christmas from the Heartbreakers. Just like last Christmas, this one comes from Merle Afferty. She lives in North Carolina, and she's the podcaster behind I Should Be Writing and a co-editor of our sister podcast, Pseudopod. The story may sound familiar to some of you. That's because she narrated it herself on her own podcast, Geek Foo Action Grip. This is a slightly revised version of it. We do buy non-exclusive audio rights, so everybody wins. The story is read today by my wife Anna and myself. So hang up your stockings by the chimney with care. It's story time. Merry Christmas from the Heartbreakers, by Merle Afferty. Santa Claus and his number one elf, Ginger Muffin, were tired of waiting for their poker buddies to show up. It was Ginger Muffin's turn to host. The elf was not into the whimsical decorating style that other elves preferred. Original art, both painting and sculpture, dotted his living area. Some were beautiful, delicately done portraits and landscapes, but those were not the ones that made Kris Kringle uncomfortable. Sculptures of animals impaled on spears, paintings of elves drowning in lava, sketches of vague horrors that were all the more disturbing for their vagueness. They all resided in the basement. The basement with the card table. Ginger Muffin was Chris's number one elf because he wasn't distracted by the frivolities surrounding the season. He was a precise worker, so Chris tried to keep his discomfort around the elf a secret. The poker games were difficult. Ginger Muffin's taste of music did not walk the path of the Christmas Carol. He preferred American classic rock. The only non-art items Ginger Muffin kept in his basement were his aging cassette player and a small stack of tapes. Chris stacked his poker chips. Green, red, two green, two red, three green, and so on. The colors cheered him. He popped open his third beer as Ginger Muffin flipped the tape over again. Chris cleared his throat.
It doesn't look like they're going to show. We could play gin.
I prefer vodka, Ginger Muffin said without humor. He picked up the open bottle of Stoli and splashed some into his glass.
Look, I'm sure the guys got busy, Chris said,
wishing he hadn't been the one stuck with the elf's bad mood. Ginger Muffin stared into his glass as if it had offended him. And why are they busy when I have more responsibilities than any of them? Chris tried to change the subject.
Why do you keep that old beat-up boombox? You could get a CD player cheap these days. Or an iPod. I could get you one for Christmas.
Ginger Muffin stared at him. I like the antiques, Ginger Muffin said carefully, and Chris groaned inwardly. Tapes and records require you to pause in the middle of the album to flip to the other side, making you relish the music, decide whether you want to keep listening. It forces people to savor the moment.
All right, Chris said.
Ginger Muffin leaned back and closed his eyes as Tom Petty sang about an American girl. He leaned over to turn the volume down.
You know, Tom Petty's been around for a while now.
Chris nodded, unsure of Ginger Muffin's point.
Since 1961. The guy's amazing, but he is just one man. His solo career's been good, but did you know that many of the Heartbreakers played for him when he was solo? And yet, it's always Tom Petty, or Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Not the Heartbreakers. The average fan'll know Tom Petty and all of the words to American Girl, but I bet they don't know who the other Heartbreakers' names are, or what they're like.
They're okay, for the most part, Chris said. Except for that bit about the drugs, of course.
Ginger Muffin glared at him.
Yes, of course. You've been inside their houses.
Look, I think I know where this is going, Chris said,
but Ginger Muffin cut him off.
Do you? The Heartbreakers have been making Tom Petty sound good for years, and no one gives a damn. Tom Petty gets all of the credit.
Chris wondered if he was sober enough to have this discussion.
You're not talking about Tom Petty.
Ginger Muffin slammed his hand down on the table.
Damn right I'm not!
Chris's carefully stacked poker chips fell over in a clatter of Christmas.
You get all the credit, all the stories, all the praise. I'm tired of getting none of the credit year after year. I'm so sick of it.
Ginger Muffin, you agreed to that when we started this whole thing, Chris said,
anger burning through his buzz.
I do the public work and you guys manage the details. It's worked for this long. Why are you upset about it now?
Tom Petty began belting out Breakdown. Ginger Muffin reached over and poured himself another drink. He took a deep breath.
You can't do it without us. You're nothing without all the people who help you. Where do you think Tom Petty would be without the Heartbreakers? He'd just be a guy with a guitar.
Quit? Is that what you're talking about?
Chris said. A small voice in the back of his head shouted warnings at him, but he didn't listen.
You don't think 20 elves aren't ready to jump into your shoes? Go ahead. I can make it without you just fine. You don't think I've got a backup plan? I've had one for years.
Get out of my house, Tom Petty,
Ginger Muffin said, and Chris stood up, his belly bumping against the table and rocking it back towards the elf. The vodka bottle toppled, spilling the last of its contents into Ginger Muffin's lap. Chris stomped out with a tune of Don't Come Around Here No More following him. Rose Claus sat at the kitchen table with her hands wrapped around a cup of tea. She peered up at Chris through her round glasses.
So you are telling me that Ginger Muffin quit?
Chris stopped stamping around the kitchen.
Yes. Haven't you been listening?
She nodded calmly.
And you didn't officially relieve him of his duties by taking his keys?
Well, no, I didn't think of that. I was too angry.
And then he went into the room of unexplainable things and stole the time stone.
Chris froze.
What?
Pepper Pot told me before you came home. So now we're going to have to figure out how to do Christmas Eve without the stone. You are going to deliver presents to millions of children in the span of a couple of hours with no time stone to help you.
The keys.
Why had he forgotten to get Ginger Muffin's keys? And if he's angry enough, he could destroy the stone and we could die tomorrow, Christmas be damned.
Chris collapsed at the table and held his head.
What have I done?
In rally, Madison D'Agostino clutched her mother's hand while waiting in Santa's line. Santa Claus gently lowered a boy to the floor. Madison wrinkled her nose as she surveyed the man. Mommy, he's not the real Santa. Elaine D'Agostino felt ashamed at her cop-out, but delivered the time-honored lie. He's Santa's helper, honey. The real Santa is busy getting ready for Christmas, so he has his helpers talk to kids. Elaine could see the battle of determined innocence with maturing logic on Madison's face. She suppressed the sigh of relief when innocence won, and Madison scampered to the mall Santa's lap to tell him about the Dora the Explorer doll she wanted. Elaine hovered nearby and wondered how she was going to afford anything her daughter was demanding. She had decided not to spend the usual $60 on a tree this year. That would help. Madison would miss the tree, though. Elaine was following the familiar path that led to depression and wine when she felt a tap on her lower back. She turned, whapping someone with her purse. Oh, I'm so sorry. She pulled her hand back, immediately uncomfortable about seeming to patronize him for being small. Dwarf? She wasn't sure what he was, only that she whapped him in the face. He glared up at her, rubbing his forehead, and she silently cursed her politically correct 90s college experience. The person of small stature was dressed as a Santa's elf. Green velvet hat, green costume, and flawless pointy ears. He stepped around her.
Excuse me, I need to talk to Santa.
He went up to Santa and placed a small rolled-up paper into Santa's gloved hand. Santa looked startled. The dwarf spoke to Santa briefly and walked away with Madison waving to him. Elaine lost sight of him in the throng of Christmas shoppers. Madison skipped up to her.
Santa said he had to read an important letter from the North Pole from the real Santa.
Oh, good, Elaine said. Come on, honey, we need to get home.
Don't we need to get a Christmas tree first? Madison asked.
Chris could not get in touch with Ginger Muffin. The elf had barricaded his house with candy canes sucked to sharpness. November edged into December, and elf-delivered notes placed in his mailbox came back with, "Don't come around here no more," scribbled on them.
"What does that mean?" asked Rose.
Chris looked at the note.
"He's stuck on this metaphor of me being Tom Petty and him being a heartbreaker."
Rose stared at him.
"You know, I'm glad I haven't been invited to these poker nights. But if he wants to play that game..."
She took the note from him. Underneath Ginger Muffin's handwriting, she wrote, "Don't do me like that. I need to know. I won't back down." She handed it back to the waiting elf.
"You'll just make him more angry," Chris said, but not caring much. He had other things to worry about.
He looked at the kitchen table with their map of the world spread out. Little flags stood up in every city, most of them green, some of them red.
"We're nearly completely covered. We might actually pull this off."
Rose pointed at a red flag in the western USA.
"There was that felon who played Santa in Denver who can't do it. And then one in Sydney who was too old to handle the strain. A handful here and there who can't be trusted. It looks good, but we're still too thin. We need to go to Plan C."
Chris looked up in alarm.
"There's a Plan C?"
His wife wrapped a short arm as far as she could around his ample waist.
"Honey, I've got it down to Plan J. It won't be easy, and it won't be pretty, but we'll be fine."
"Why didn't I make you number one elf?" he asked, and leaned down to kiss her.
A knock on the kitchen door interrupted them. Rose tidied her hair and took a letter from a tearful elf.
"Did he do something to you, Crumpet?"
she asked. The elf shook his head.
"No, ma'am, but he told me what was in the letter."
Chris took it from Rose and read it. He frowned.
"He wrote the song name wrong."
Rose looked at it and paled.
"No, that's just a message."
Underneath her message, Ginger Muffin had written, "It won't be Christmas all over again." Kenneth and Jackie Smith walked down a pier in South Florida, keeping a careful body width between them. Kenneth pretended to admire the sailboats, but he was really there to say goodbye to his fishing boat.
After years of grinding him down, Jackie had finally won. They were selling the boat. He was so tired, too tired to argue anymore, too tired to divorce her. She always won. Jackie walked with a clipped gait down the pier, smiling slightly.
"Whoa, man," slurred a voice to their right.
A thin man slumped on the railing of a fishing boat. A beer bottle dangled precariously from his fingers as he leaned over the rail. Kenneth did a quick scan of the boat. The telltale, colorful Dancing Bears decal sat above the boat's name, Forever Jerry. Here we go.
"If I didn't know he was dead, I'd swear he was standing right here," the man said, pointing his beer bottle at Kenneth. "Jerry Garcia!"
"I get that a lot," Kenneth said, "but I'm not him." Jackie laughed at him as they walked away.
"Oh, look, drunks are calling you Jerry. That's just great. I keep telling you to shave that beard."
He winced at the nasty tone in her voice.
"I'm not shaving," he said.
It was his last stance. She had gotten her way on the boat, their purple house, and everything else in their life. But the beard was staying. But damn, it was either Jerry Garcia or Santa Claus. All the time. As he was thinking dark thoughts, Kenneth noticed a short woman coming their way. At first he thought it was a child, but realized she was an adult, as she wore fisher's garb, with a woolly hat covering her ears, and what looked to be specially made heavy brown pants and coat to keep her warm in the sea air. But why would she need such warmth in Florida? To his surprise, the woman stopped in front of him.
"Mr. Kenneth Smith?"
Yes?
She held out a rolled piece of paper.
"I have a letter for you."
The paper was fragile, and Kenneth unrolled it carefully. The moment he touched the paper, something shiny adhered to his fingertips. He felt lightheaded. Nutmeg wafted from the paper.
"To Kenneth Smith. The North Pole is in a dire circumstance. I need your help. I am unable to travel the globe on Christmas Eve at my normal speed. You will be given children's names, addresses, and their toys. You will gain my powers of stealth and knowledge of those naughty and nice. You will deliver the toys, after which the memory of your work will leave you. Don't worry, you will be compensated for your work. This is an emergency. We need your help to keep the world's children happy at Christmas time. We thank you for your attention to this. Santa Claus."
Kenneth read it through twice.
"This is true, right?" he said to the waiting dwarf.
His heart pounded heavily in his ears.
"Tragically true, sir," she said. "Can we count on you to help?"
Kenneth nodded blankly.
"Santa thanks you, sir."
She turned and walked off, disappearing into the fading evening. Kenneth was dimly aware of his wife at his side.
"What the hell was that about?" she asked.
She took the letter from him, and the familiar pinched look came to her face. The glitter adhered to her fingers as well, and she sighed when she was done reading. She believed it too. Something on that paper.
"You can't do this. We're going to Marcia's house for Christmas Eve dinner," she said.
Chris sat at the kitchen table. It was noon on Christmas Eve. He had already changed into the red suit he had worn during that fateful night the little Nast boy had caught sight of him in 1862. It wasn't his favorite suit. He had preferred the blue one, but it was now what they expected. They expected a lot of things. The magic, the speed, the careful separation of his myth from Jesus's. Also, there was no Atkins diet for Chris, no matter how much he and Rose wanted to see him thinner. But heart disease or diabetes wouldn't kill the immortal Santa. Well, he had been immortal. Chris looked at his hands, wondering if they would suddenly start to wrinkle and shrivel. What would kill him? Would time catch up with him on the 26th, making him turn from a fat and rosy-cheeked man into a pile of dust? Or would he and Rose merely become mortal, prone to heart failure, breast cancer, and bus accidents like everyone else? He'd never thought to ask Kronos, the god who'd gifted him with the stone. Rose bustled into the kitchen and put the kettle on the stove. The flame burst on with a puff, and Chris sniffled. Rose sat next to him and took his hand.
"We're not dead yet, Chris. We've still got one good night left in us. And it won't be as long as usual."
Chris chuckled despite his tears. Christmas Eve usually lasted 2 months for the North Pole residents. Time kept going for them as they aided Santa. He was not plagued by fatigue on the night itself, but when he got home, he usually slept until February. Without the time stone to stop the clocks, he had only time to visit a couple of dozen houses, maybe 100 if he was fast. Rose would be doing all the hard work. She and her group of elves were managing the worldwide network of Santas, monitoring for problems and sending teams of bailout elves. He worried about her. He would only be able to work one city for the 13 hours of darkness available to him. She would be on call from sundown in Sydney until sunrise in Hawaii. She would have some time of relaxation while the non-Christmas celebrators were having their nights, mainly the Asian and Middle Eastern countries. But when Europe and the Americas needed Santa, it would be getting busy. His other elves had promised that their support was still strong. Their overtime meant more to Chris than he could express, and he realized that he had been taking his employees for granted, just as Ginger Muffin had accused.
"Are you sure you'll be okay?" Chris asked.
"Of course I will. I manage thousands of elves all year round. I do without my husband for a span of 4 months a year, while I live a 14-month year. This is a new challenge, that's all."
The kettle began to whistle. Chris felt the question rise to his lips and couldn't suppress it.
"Do you feel like a heartbreaker, too? Do I not give you enough credit?"
She laughed.
"You must be joking. No, I don't mind that you get the love and attention and that I am depicted as a little old lady who bakes cookies. I got into this racket because I love you, because we do some good here. And," she leaned down and tweaked his nose, "because it's fun. If it has to end, well, we had a good run of it, Chris."
She placed the tea in front of him and kissed him on the cheek.
"Now I have some final plans to make. You relax. You won't be on call for several hours."
They'd had so many more lifetimes together than most people had. Was he ready to let it all go? Chris sighed. He would have to be. He pulled out his map and began studying the area Rose had assigned him. He blinked and then looked closer.
"Oh, Rose," he said, "you didn't."
Kenneth stood outside his first house. He was still a bit dazed at his situation, but determined to do his job. He was surprised to discover that his list of nice children, printed on that same glittery paper, was much shorter than he'd expected. He knew that other Santas were also helping out in the Cocoa Beach area, but he only had 40 homes to visit. He assumed that there were more in the area, but some did not celebrate Christmas, and there were always the naughty ones to consider. The sack, toys, list, and suit had arrived at noon that day, wrapped in a brown box with a red bow. He thought he caught a scent of gingerbread and peppermint when he opened it. Jackie hovered nearby, annoyance creasing her face. She had accepted the reality of Santa the way she accepted the reality of the Democratic Party. Both existed, but she wasn't happy about their influence in her life.
"Are you sure you would rather do this than spend time with your family on Christmas Eve?"
He glanced at her, for once not feeling the arrow of guilt stabbing into his gut.
"Of course I am. It'll be great."
He read over the list, smiling when he saw their granddaughter's name.
"Greta's here."
"Of course she is. She's perfect."
When Kenneth left, his wife was on the phone with their daughter.
"Honey, I'm sorry, but your dad is too tired."
Her voice implied that he was no such thing.
"He's been playing Santa at the Y. I will be there in about 20 minutes. Tell Greta that Grandpa will be there in the morning."
Now, standing at his first apartment in his heavy red suit, which somehow did not overheat him in the 60-degree evening, he was unsure what to do. It was only 7 o'clock. Was he to just walk in? He finally admitted to himself that he was terrified. He had stopped believing in Santa himself at an early age when his parents were unemployed. If Santa refused poor children presents, he must either be a right bastard or not real. The former was unthinkable, the latter was heartbreaking. So now, what was the truth? Why didn't he get a present that year? Naughty. The word floated past his ears. Had he been naughty that year? Experimentations with his mother's makeup and the family dog, screaming and crying at his parents when they couldn't afford a Mickey Mouse cake for his birthday. His insides began to sink.
He'd had poor friends who had at least gotten something for Christmas, even if it was a small toy they'd ended up treasuring, but he hadn't gotten so much as a plastic ball that year.
"Hey, Santa!"
The words broke him out of his nostalgia. His heart turned to ice. They're going to find me out, arrest me for breaking and entering. It was another Santa. Kenneth could tell immediately that he was also helping out the real Santa. His suit was immaculate, his beard real, and there was that odd sense of magic to him.
"First house?" Santa asked.
Yeah, just got started," Kenneth said. "Got any advice?"
"Well, look for a chimney first. If they don't have one, go for the back door. They won't be there. Santa gave us the houses of people who'll be away at church or with family first. Then later, they'll all be asleep."
"Chimneys in Florida?" Kenneth looked up. A tiny chimney poked out of the top of the house.
"You're kidding."
The other Santa was gone. Kenneth shook his head and walked around the side of the house, trying to figure out how to get to the roof. In the darkness, a glittering ladder hung from the roof. It was made of holly and candy canes and looked unable to support more than a mouse's weight. He put his hands on the ladder.
"You really have got to be kidding."
The ladder, however, was strong. He climbed it quickly, the pack on his back weighing nothing, and stood on the roof.
"What now?"
As if hearing him, the chimney grew to twice his size, supporting another holly ladder down the inside.
"All right, if it's going to be this easy."
He started the dark descent into the house. Once stepping from the massive gas fireplace that shrank once he had exited, he spoke not a word and went straight to his work.
"Is Santa coming tonight?" Madison asked as Elaine tucked her in. "Of course he is, sweetie," Elaine said. "Will he bring us a real Christmas tree?" she asked, and Elaine suppressed her annoyance and regret. "Honey, Santa brings presents, not trees. I told you we can't afford a real tree this year. I'm sorry." Madison's lower lip stuck out. "I want a candy cane to sleep with like Cindy Lou Who, and all my stuffed animals." As Elaine gathered the stuffed animals, hoping Madison would forget her desire for the candy cane, she caught a whiff of cinnamon. "Honey, did you leave Christmas cookies in here like I told you not to?" Madison didn't reply. She was asleep, covers tucked under her chin, a candy cane clutched tightly in her fist. "Where did she?" Elaine asked. A man's chuckle came from outside the door. She dropped the toys and scrabbled for her cell phone to call 911.
The North Pole control room had been expanded with computers, phones, fax machines, and runner elves to fulfill Rose's command on a moment's notice. She was on the phone, calming a Santa in Greenland. It seemed his charms had failed in the middle of delivering presents to a minister's family. The minister had chased Santa from his house with a baseball bat, and the Santa was threatening to sue.
"Sir, no court can try us. We appreciate your help, and you will be recompensed," Rose said, and hung up on his frantic arguments.
Rose turned to one of her 25 runners and said,
"Backup plan for Section 134 in Greenland."
The elf nodded, her red braids bobbing.
"Cupcake," Rose called, summoning a plump female. "I need you to tune the stealth meter for just a little more power. We're stretched to the limit."
The elf ran off, bumping into three waiting elves. After they'd untangled, Rose accepted the reports from the field. Things were running more smoothly than she ever could have hoped. She sent another elf off to fetch a cup of tea and smiled to herself. Now, if Chris could work his part of the deal, they might actually live to see next Christmas.
"Mrs. Claus!"
Glitter ran up to her, his hat askew and his cheeks flushed.
"Code red in Cocoa Beach, and code yellow in Raleigh!"
Code yellow she could deal with. They had 7 backup plans for dealing with the police. Rose could deal with code yellow in her sleep. Code red, however.
Eric and Sarah Reed stared at the body on the floor. They had known he was Santa when they touched him. Santa Claus was lying on their floor. Eric had shot Santa. Eric had been dozing in front of the TV after putting their son, Eddie, to bed. Sarah was watching Miracle on 34th Street, cuddling next to her sleeping husband, when she caught a whiff of nutmeg. She didn't think much of it, as she had some wine mulling on the stove, but she sat up with a start when a thump sounded from down the hall. Eric stirred and opened his eyes. "Are you okay? What was that?" Sarah's eyes were wide when she pointed to the man who was entering their son's room. Eric swore and ran to get the handgun he had locked in his desk. The man, dressed as Santa Claus, had come out of Eddie's room humming a quiet, off-key tune to himself. He stopped when he saw Eric, whose hands were shaking badly, pointing a gun at him. "Oh, shit," he said, and startled Eric so badly that he pulled the trigger. "What did you do?" Sarah cried, pulling the gun out of Eric's hand and tossing it across the room. Eric stammered something, and Sarah turned her back on him as her EMT training took over. She rushed to examine the body. The moment she touched him, she knew. It was Santa. Santa Claus lay bleeding to death on their floor, smelling of freshly baked cookies. He needed medical attention. "Call Miguel! Bring me a towel!" she ordered her husband, and he ran to get the phone. Sarah loosened Santa's collar, white shirt and red suspenders, just like the cartoons, and looked at the damage. The bullet was lodged deep in his beefy chest, and there didn't look like there was an exit wound. It had possibly nicked his heart, lungs, or worse. Her husband had finally reached her boss on the phone. "Yeah, Miguel, this is Eric Reed, Sarah's husband. We have a situation here. We shot an intruder. We need you to come." Eric hung up and covered his face with his hands. "Eric, I need that towel now," Sarah cried, and he leapt into motion. She pressed on the wound. How quickly could Miguel get there? She guessed 2 minutes. "Listen, go check and make sure Eddie didn't wake up. This is not something we want him to see," she said through clenched teeth. She tried to imagine how they would explain to Eddie that Daddy had killed Santa, but pushed that thought from her mind. That was not their most pressing problem. As Eric reached Eddie's room, the door opened and their sleepy 4-year-old peeked out. "Santa?" "He's in the house. I heard him outside my daughter's room." Elaine clutched the phone and hugged the complaining Madison to her chest as they crouched on the floor of Madison's closet. "Ma'am, we're sending someone right over," the 911 operator said. "If you would feel safer, stay on the line." "Yes, thank you," Elaine said, sobbing. Madison squirmed out of her arms and peeked through the slats in the closet door. "Mommy, it was Santa!" She tried to push the door open. Elaine jerked her back. "No, it wasn't. There is no Santa. Please be quiet," Elaine hissed and hugged her again. "But you said he was real." "Honey, we can't talk about this right now. We have to wait for the police to get here. Now hush." Madison began to cry, a soft little girl cry, and Elaine alternated between hating her for making noise, hating the intruder for ruining Christmas, and hating herself for not dealing with this calmly. Someone pounded on the front door and Elaine screamed. Should she risk leaving Madison alone here to answer it? He could still be in the house. The door banged open and police ran in yelling, "Mrs. D'Agostino, this is the police. Tell us where you are." "They're here," she said into the phone, sobbing again. "Thank you so much. Thank you." She turned off the phone and tumbled out of the closet, leaving the crying Madison. In the chaos that followed, police searching the house, Elaine and Madison shivering outside with an officer, Madison asking to see the officer's gun, Elaine never noticed the living room. When she and Madison went back into the house after the officers had left, she gave a small cry at the sight. A tall Christmas tree stood in the center of the room, shining with white lights and decorated with multicolored balls. Underneath sat 2 presents for Madison, from Santa. An envelope saying, "To Elaine," was stuck in the branches. Madison danced around the room. "See? It was Santa! I told you! You were wrong! There is a Santa!" Elaine opened the envelope. The paper inside was slightly glittery and smelled of gingerbread. "Sorry to cause such a fuss. I hope this gift makes up for it. Love, Santa." "I guess he is real," she said, dazed. Sarah was muttering every swear word she knew as her husband tried to console their screaming son. She knew Miguel would have to call the police and expected them to be here soon after the EMTs, possibly before. The front door opened and 5 small people in doctor's lab coats entered the room.
One of them, a blonde woman, handed her a star-shaped card that said, Elf Medical Team Alpha, Dr. Cookie Evergreen. Thank you, Sarah. We can take him from here, she said simply. Can you save him? Sarah asked. Cookie didn't look at her. Of course we can. We're so sorry, she said, feeling inadequate as the surprisingly strong elves lifted Santa onto a stretcher and shook some clove-smelling dust over him. Can I do anything? Cookie didn't look up as she continued strapping Santa in. No, you likely saved his life. We are sorry you were startled. They were sorry? Sarah felt impotent as the elves whirled the jolly old elf from her house. A siren screamed in the distance. Go on, I'll catch up, Dr. Evergreen told her team. She looked in the direction of Eddie's room and trotted to the door. Sarah followed. Eddie clung to his father's chest, his face buried, and wailed. Dr. Evergreen tapped him lightly on the shoulder and he looked up, snot and tears glistening on his red face. Merry Christmas, she said, pressing a candy into his hand. She motioned for Sarah to follow her out and said, He won't remember anything once he eats that candy. And here. She dug into her lab coat and handed two envelopes to Sarah. She left, closing the door behind her. He's asleep, Eric's voice made her jump. What was in that candy? Don't know, Sarah said, handing Eric the envelope with his name on it. She tore off the end of the envelope, and out came a gift certificate for a year's worth of martial arts classes. Eric held up his, smiling weakly. Coupon for a class on keeping your home safe with a clear head. The siren stopped and car doors slammed. If she could save Santa and make Eddie forget, why can't she make Miguel turn around? Sarah asked. I guess we have to deal with it. We did shoot Santa, Eric said, and went to let in Miguel as Sarah pondered a good story to tell her boss.
Kenneth woke up in a room decorated with garland and candles. The room looked like the perfect rooms in the Christmas catalogs. Wood-paneled walls and floors. Large windows with snow piled up on the panes. A Santa suit with a hole in the lapel draped over a wooden chair. How did he get here? He wasn't sure what he was doing there, but he was comfortable and warm. A small woman smiled at him from beside the bed.
I am Dr. Evergreen, she said, offering her tiny hand.
He shook it.
You're a lucky man. Unlucky that your stealth charm failed in the house of an armed and easily frightened man, but lucky that his wife happened to be an EMT.
He blinked. Where am I?
The North Pole. We had to come back here to give you a new heart, she said matter-of-factly.
He leaned back on the pillow. My wife is going to kill me.
No, I very much doubt that, Dr. Evergreen said.
The door opened and Jackie rushed in. She stopped short of the bed, pale and shaking. Kenneth steeled himself, expecting a lecture.
I thought I'd lost you, she said, her voice very small.
Well, you didn't, he said.
I didn't want to lose you. Life with you dead would be worse than life with you alive.
Kenneth nearly laughed at the backhanded compliment. I'm still here. They said I have a new heart. She averted her eyes and stared at the wall.
I can't do this again. I can't lose you and feel like I didn't get a chance to make anything better between us. We're not happy. We haven't been in a very long time. We need to get help.
Her statements were not mean or accusatory. Kenneth was surprised to feel his usual sense of anxiety, the feeling he'd associated with his wife for the past 25 years, leave him. He nodded. I think that would be a good idea. She sat on the edge of the bed but didn't touch him.
I'm sorry, she finally said.
He reached out to her. Her hand was cold. Me too. He smiled. It's going to be okay. Chris actually enjoyed Christmas Eve this year, more so than the previous Christmases. It reminded him of the first few, where he made and delivered toys to the children of the nearby village, not worrying about the entire world. He took his time this year, stopping to watch children sleep and adults enjoy the evening. He saved the most important houses for about 10 p.m., as he wanted to make sure he caught them at home. It was the first house he'd been to in years that didn't have a child. He was gratified to see two of his intended together, two old friends sharing a drink. he materialized, allowed for the exclamations of shock, disbelief, and finally acceptance, and said,
"Mr. Petty, Mr. Blair, can I trouble you and your colleagues for a small favor?"
Ginger Muffin woke on Christmas Day with a hangover, like most days since the fight with Chris. He was more sober when his boss was around, that was for sure. He glared out his window where white snow glittered in the morning sun. A red rooster stood on his windowsill, crowing and ruffling its feathers. It spied him, squawked, and fluttered to the ground. It gave a quick look back at him before prancing away. Ginger Muffin remembered something about a note he'd sent to Chris's house, something akin to a clumsy death threat involving Tom Petty's Christmas tune. The thought made him sick. Or maybe that was the vodka. He came out of the bathroom feeling mildly better and craving greasy food. He staggered into the kitchen and swore an old oath at the sight before him. The card table sat next to his kitchen table, an intricate collection of balanced toothpicks that could hold no weight, certainly nothing like the massive box sitting atop the card table. The box was unwrapped. The only decoration was a large bow. It was a Bose stereo system. Stacked on top of it were an iPod, an Apple laptop, and a white CD box set. Ginger Muffin walked forward slowly and picked it up. It was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' Playback. Written on the front of the box was, "To Ginger Muffin, the best heartbreaker. Ben Montench, Mike Campbell, Ron Blair, Stan Lynch." "You did it. You old bastard, you did it," Ginger Muffin said. He put down the box and looked at the hall. He had no idea what to do with all of this technology. He looked at the stack for a long time, and then decided he'd call Chris to help him set it up.
"Like it," Chris said.
Ginger Muffin jumped. His former boss was making coffee in the kitchen. He looked exhausted, but very pleased with himself. "How did you get in here?" Ginger Muffin asked.
"Oh, I can go wherever I want on Christmas Eve. It's one of the rules," Chris said.
He raised his eyebrow.
"I thought you knew that."
"Then why didn't you
come in and take the stone? I didn't know if you'd hidden it somewhere and didn't have the time to check. I couldn't gamble time on Christmas Eve. I also figured you needed some time off. You've been terribly stressed lately."
Chris handed him a mug of coffee.
"I'm sorry I took you for granted. You were right."
Ginger Muffin looked at the presents Chris had left for him, and then padded down the hall to his bedroom, where a heavy oval stone lay under his mattress. It was said that it was one of the stones Kronos had swallowed instead of his own children, and that had infused the stone with the power to stop time. He hefted the rock and went back into the kitchen, where Chris was reading the iPod instructions. He handed the stone to Chris.
"Merry Christmas, boss."
And that was our story. Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Archive CDs are available at poddisc.com, and we hope you'll check out our sister podcast, Pseudopod, for the best in audio horror. Our opening music was by permission of Daikaiju. This closing song comes from Twisted Sister. No kidding, it's Twisted Sister's cover of O Come All Ye Faithful on their album A Twisted Christmas. We're playing it with permission through the PodSafe Music Network. Whoever you are, whatever you believe, joy and love are doable. My love to all of you. Happy holidays.